This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Great to be with you. I appreciate you joining me today. I'm Joel Hilliker. Is North Korea still a threat? If you remember, it was only a couple of years ago that North Korea was testing nuclear weapons and long-range missiles that could hit the United States. There was a lot of alarm about it. President Donald Trump has been aiming for a peace deal with North Korea for some time now. It hasn't happened yet, but this small Asian nation has been quiet on the nuclear testing front and the long-range missile front for going on 2 years now. However, recently this nation has been active in another arena, that is short-range missile tests. This isn't a direct threat to America, but we're going to hear a report today from Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about why it is still a very concerning development that could help reshape global politics. Lately in America, we've been hearing back and forth about whether the nation is heading for recession. Some say it's inevitable. President Trump says this is being manufactured to try to hurt his chance for re-election. Trumpet writer Andrew Miller has a report showing us some of the fundamental realities that show who is right and why we should be concerned about this. We'll also have a conversation with Trumpet writer Josue Michels about European culture. The European Commission is promoting Europe's cultural heritage in an effort to bring Europeans together. But the downside of this trend is how closely it is linked with Europe's military history, specifically that of the Holy Roman Empire. I'm going to conclude the program today by sharing a short article I read by a military veteran recently about how today's kids don't know how good they have it. We'll begin, though, by hearing about these missile tests that North Korea has been up to in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
North Korea has been conducting test launches of short-range ballistic missiles with increasing frequency. And at first glance, this might look like business as usual from the regime of Kim Jong-un. But a closer look shows that there are likely some covert machinations at play here that could be working toward a major shift in Asia's security dynamic. The most recent tests came on August 24th, when North Korea fired two short-range ballistic missiles from a location near the country's eastern coast. North Korea's state-run news agency said it was a test of a newly developed super-large multiple rocket launcher. Both of the missiles fired ended up falling into the Sea of Japan, and these two missiles brought the total count to at least 18. At least 18 short-range missiles that the North has test launched since May. So there's been a whole flurry of activity there, and one important aspect of these tests is the way the Trump administration in the U.S. has responded to them, which has been essentially to shrug them off. President Trump has stressed that these are short-range missiles. He has emphasized that unlike missiles with longer ranges that could strike many key American assets and even parts of the U.S. mainland, these short-range missiles don't pose much of a threat to America. And he has said the U.S. is not terribly concerned with the ongoing tests. Here's a clip from President Trump from an interview in late July, just after the North had fired a spate of these short-range missiles.
And in the case of North Korea, I'm actually getting along very well with him, but we'll see what happens. I mean, you know, the sanctions are on, the hostages are back, we're getting the remains back, they haven't done nuclear testing. They really haven't tested missiles other than, you know, smaller ones, which is something that lots test.
So we've really come a long way from fire and fury. That was the phrase that President Trump used back in 2017 to describe how the U.S. would answer North Korea's weapons tests. But now the president seems to have endless patience for these tests, as long as the North limits them to short-range missiles. And it's important to note that part of the president's motivation for downplaying these test launches is because he doesn't want to throw cold water on the chances that he and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un can still come to a deal about denuclearizing North Korea. That's been one of Trump's foreign policy goals since the start of his presidency, and there's reason to believe that the president feels that a breakthrough could be near. And that would be an astounding victory for him, which would be especially valuable right now as he's trying to convince the American people to vote him into a second presidential term. So because of all this, President Trump wants to avoid taking any actions or even making any substantive statements that would irritate Kim Jong-un and thereby reduce the likelihood of making a denuclearization breakthrough with the North. But the trouble with this approach is that Japan and South Korea are treaty allies of America. Both of these nations depend largely on the U.S. for their national security and for defending their interests, and both are within range of these missiles that North Korea is increasingly testing. So South Korea, and even more so Japan, are becoming quite alarmed by the Trump administration's downplaying of these weapons tests. On August 25th, Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe met with President Trump on the sidelines of the G7 summit in France. This was the day after the latest North Korean missiles had been launched and landed in the Sea of Japan, very near to Mr. Abe's country. And when the topic came up, President Trump once again essentially shrugged off North Korea's test launches. But Abe, who is normally an ardent supporter of President Trump, contradicted him and stressed that these tests are not something to be brushed aside, and he said they are a clear violation of UN resolutions. Abe demonstrated how concerned he was by the US's casual dismissal of the test launches. So this could work out to drive a wedge between the US and its Asian allies, Japan and South Korea. And really, that may be exactly what North Korea and its main allies, China and Russia, are hoping to accomplish from these short-range missile tests. It's no secret that China and Russia are supporting the North Korean regime. They frequently use their UN veto power to protect it. They often violate UN sanctions, including those that they signed on to, in order to assist the North. China and Russia are really the reason why the North has been able to stay afloat for all these years. And they also call many of the shots for much of North Korea's foreign policy from behind the scenes. And they use that power to accomplish their goals. And it's also no secret that one major goal of China and Russia is to see the U.S. kicked out of their neighborhood. They detest having tens of thousands of U.S. troops stationed in Japan and tens of thousands more in South Korea. So they would love to see Washington's alliances with Tokyo and Seoul come to an end. Back in August of 2009, TheTrumpet.com's managing editor, Mr. Brad McDonald, discussed particularly the Chinese part of the North Korean equation. He wrote, quote, "China's leaders support the North Korean regime because a rogue North Korea serves China's ambitions, both within the region and in the global arena. First, the existence of an unpredictable, highly volatile nuclear aspirant is a distraction to China's competitors in the region. But the ultimate and most worrying reason Beijing sustains North Korea is that North Korea's ideologies and ambitions align perfectly with China's top global priority, which is undermining the United States." End quote. And Russia's main goals are almost perfectly parallel to those of China in this regard. Both nations are actively working to bring an end to the era of global U.S. dominance, which is clear from most every aspect of their foreign policy. So what we're seeing with these short-range North Korean missile tests could very well be a calculated effort by China and Russia to work toward that goal. It's become clear over the years that North Korea does little that isn't endorsed or even encouraged by China and, to a lesser degree, Russia. So this spate of missile tests could well be an instance of these two Asian giants pulling the levers from behind the scenes, encouraging the North to keep firing these weapons, and knowing full well that President Trump won't want to react to them, partly because their range is beneath the threshold of what could threaten America, and partly due to his fear of spoiling the chances of denuclearizing the North. And Russia and China would also well know how profoundly this rankles Japan and South Korea. So it is working toward China and Russia's goal of weakening Washington's Asian alliances, and thereby giving Beijing and Moscow a freer hand in the region. In recent years, there have been discussions from both South Korea and Japan about removing the U.S. troops from their countries. And both nations have been boosting their own military power, partly so that they'll be equipped to go it alone if they were to split from the U.S. In recent years, we've also heard statements from President Trump about his discontentment regarding how much America pays to keep Japan and South Korea safe. So deep strains already exist in these U.S.-Asian alliances, and with America shrugging off North Korea's missile tests, the strains could grow far deeper. Back in 2017, when North Korea's aggression was at a major peak, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury said the world should be more concerned about Russia and China than about North Korea because it's those two nations who allow the North to behave as it does. Mr. Fleury explained that his analysis of the dynamic there is based on Bible prophecy. There are prophecies in the books of Daniel and Revelation that describe an end-time confederacy of Asian nations that would rise up in the end time. And there's a passage in Ezekiel 38 which shows that the lead nation in this block will be Russia. And it says China will be under Russia in a position of junior leadership. So these are the prophecies that form the basis of Mr. Fleury's understanding of the dynamic in Asia. And Mr. Fleury wrote, quote, "The Bible's prophecies show that, in a sense, the North Korea crisis is a massive distraction from the real threat posed by China and Russia. These powerful Asian nations are the only reason North Korea is able to operate so freely, and Bible prophecy shows that they pose a threat many times greater than the one from North Korea." End quote. It's also important to note that in Ezekiel 38, just after it says Russia will be the head of the end-time Asian Confederacy, with China as its secondary partner, the passage goes on to list ancient names for several less powerful modern Asian countries, showing that they will also be in this bloc. And among the names there are Gomer and Togarma, which are the main peoples in the Koreas as well as Japan today. So when we place these Bible passages alongside prophecies in Leviticus and elsewhere, showing that American power will soon come to an end, it becomes clear that the days are numbered for the U.S.-Japan and U.S.-South Korea alliances. So when we watch these ongoing short-range missile tests, we need to keep a close eye not just on North Korea, but also on China and Russia, and on the U.S. and its allies in the region. Because prophecy is clear that a massive shift will soon remove U.S. power from Asia's security dynamic. In his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, Mr. Fleury shows that with Russia's Vladimir Putin in charge and leading China, North Korea, and many others, this Asian confederacy will soon play a key role in the most violent conflict in mankind's history. But he also shows that these developments are tied to some unprecedentedly good news. He says that at the end of this fast-approaching conflict, Jesus Christ will usher in, quote, "a peaceful and prosperous new age for the entire earth."
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. It's interesting how many different dynamics there are at play here, and it's not difficult to see why Japan and South Korea would be so upset that the United States would be so nonchalant about what North Korea is doing here. I just thinking of it from President Trump's standpoint, I just wonder what your thoughts are on the efforts that Donald Trump has made to make peace with North Korea, if this is really something that, you know, the way that you're looking at it, that Russia and China would be using North Korea as a means to try to divide this alliance and to pry the United States loose from Asia. And it's not difficult to see how that would be possible. Do you feel like that's the main thing that, say, the outcome of this, that in a sense Donald Trump is being played a little bit? Or are there some... It does seem like there may be some aspects of what he has tried to do that could be positive. I just wonder what your thoughts are about just the peace overtures that he's made.
Yeah, I think there definitely is some undeniably positive fruits that have been born from Trump's peace overtures to the North. Most notably, since late 2017, we've not seen a nuclear weapons test mm-hmm. from North Korea. That's a major development. In the years leading up to that moratorium on those tests, they were happening with increasing frequency. Kim Jong-un was testing every few months increasingly advanced and powerful nuclear weapons. And that all came to a decisive end as soon as President Trump made his outreach to him. And I don't think that we should downplay just how significant that was. Likewise, long-range ballistic missiles have totally stopped since, I think it was November of 2017. So here we are 20 months without a nuclear test or a long-range ballistic missile test from North Korea. And that truly is significant because those tests were far more destabilizing to the region than the short-range ones. So it's significant in a way, but what it does is it kind of leaves Japan and South Korea feeling a bit isolated,
right?
You know, because President Trump wants to play up that victory. He wants to say, look, we haven't seen nuclear tests. We haven't seen long-range ballistic missiles tested. And that's great for everybody except for those in North Korea's immediate vicinity, mm-hmm. which happen to be U.S. treaty allies. So they feel a bit shortchanged when we repeatedly emphasize those victories, which are meaningful, but they exclude them from what might be viewed as a positive development.
It does seem like there is a certain inevitability to this when you see the United States commitment to maintaining its presence in Asia and elsewhere overseas. The trend definitely in arena after arena is that the United States is trying to draw down, that it's trying to reduce its footprint elsewhere in the world. And so in one sense, it seems like the will of the American people is in alignment with that of nations like Russia and China. You just wonder what might reverse that trend. It seems like every one of these places that what we're seeing is just this kind of inevitable decline of American power, as difficult as it might be for Japan and South Korea, and listening to Donald Trump say, you know, what, there's nothing really, this isn't very concerning to us. Right. At some point that feels like that was really kind of bound to happen.
Yeah, I think that's a really keen observation. Right now, most of the world is tired of the U.S. being the global policeman, and the United States is tired of being the global policeman. So I think we could see in the short term just an America that becomes more isolationist. We kind of pull back from these various arenas. But, you know, we know that that won't last and that ultimately that will not be a positive development for the world, because the U.S.'s policing, so to speak, has been a overwhelmingly positive and stabilizing influence.
Well, we do appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about North Korea and its short-range missile tests. He's working on an article and a video on this subject that will be posted on thetrumpet.com soon. You can watch for that. We thank you very much for your insights here.
Pleasure to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Is America heading for recession? Some say it's inevitable. President Trump says this is being manufactured to try to hurt his chance for re-election. We're going to look at some of the fundamental realities that point to the answer in this report from Andrew Miller.
The United States is heading towards economic recession. It might not seem like it. The markets are up, unemployment is down, and production is growing at roughly 3% a year. But warning signs loom on the horizon. For a couple hours on the morning of August 14th, yields on 2-year Treasury bonds were actually higher than yields on 10-year Treasury bonds. Now, normally the U.S. Treasury offers to pay investors more to buy long-term bonds like the 10-year because it does not have to pay those investors back until the bonds mature. But the Treasury raises interest on short-term bonds when investors are concerned about recession. The multinational investment bank Credit Suisse reports that recessions normally happen 18 to 24 months after yield curve inversions, like the one that just happened. So it's very likely that an economic recession will hit the United States in the next couple years. President Donald Trump is trying to delay this inevitable recession by pressuring the Federal Reserve to slash interest rates and enact quantitative easing measures. On August 19th, the president tweeted, "Our economy is very strong, despite the horrendous lack of vision by Jay Powell and the Fed. But the Democrats are trying to will the economy to be bad for the purposes of the 2020 election. Very selfish. Our dollar is so strong that it is sadly hurting other parts of the world. The Fed rate, over a fairly short period of time, should be reduced by at least 100 basis points, with perhaps some quantitative easing as well. If that happened, our economy would be even better and the world economy would be greatly and quickly enhanced. Good for everyone." Now, these moves the president is suggesting would likely grow the economy by making it easier for individuals to borrow money. But such borrowing would add to consumer debt, which is already higher than it was during the beginning of the 2008 financial crisis. And slashing interest rates would leave the Federal Reserve with no cushion to cut rates further after a recession hits. Modern economics teaches that people should borrow when times are bad and save when times are good. This is not what Americans have done. They borrowed their way out of the 2008 financial crisis and then kept on borrowing each and every year since. Total consumer debt is now over $14 trillion, and the total national debt is over $22 trillion. That means the average American household is $108,000 in debt. Now, assets like houses and cars back much of this debt, but over 16% of it is composed of unsecured debt. That means the average American household carries almost $7,000 in credit card debt and $12,000 in student loan debt. And over 40% of Americans have no savings to fall back on if a recession hits, which means many businesses and individuals will go bankrupt during the next recession unless the government bails them out. And the government does not have any financial reserves to fall back on either. The national debt is over $22 trillion. That's $12 trillion more than it was in 2008. So we've doubled the debt since the last financial crisis. So despite the economy booming, Americans will be in real danger when the next recession hits. Data from the Treasury Department's Office of Debt Management shows that the government is only 5 years away from the point where every new dollar it borrows will have to go towards funding the interest on the national debt. This is called a debt death spiral. And then if a recession hits where the government has to start bailing out businesses, it'll reach this point even sooner. Both the government and individual citizens should have spent the last 10 years of economic good times reducing their debt levels. The Bible says that a wise person saves when times are good, so he has an emergency fund when times are bad. In Proverbs 6, verses 6 through 8, it says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provides her meat in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest." Now, summer in America is almost over. Trade war with China is escalating. There will likely be a recession in the next couple years. And the government is nearing a point where it will have to borrow more money just to pay the interest on the money it borrowed to pay the interest on the money it borrowed. And the president wants Americans to borrow more money to keep the economy revved up. but America cannot keep borrowing money without putting its national security at great risk. The late Herbert W. Armstrong predicted that a financial crisis in America would likely be a catalyst prompting Europe to unite. He warned in 1984 that a massive banking crisis in America could suddenly result in triggering European nations to unify as a new world power larger than either the Soviet Union or the United States. Such a banking crisis could scare European nations into surrendering control to a central authority. And once the euro is supported by a government strong enough to regulate its members' tax and spending policies, the dollar's day as dominant reserve currency will be over. It'll be a co-regent at best, an isolated North American currency at worst. And this forecast is not just based on financial conditions, it's also based on Bible prophecy. In his landmark book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, Mr. Armstrong explained that the Anglo-Saxon peoples who settled Britain and the United States are actually descended from the ancient Israelites. And this truth means that all end-time prophecies of the Bible concerning Israel are primarily directed at the United States and Britain. Other prophecies reveal that Assyria will be the rod of God's anger and the staff of his indignation against end-time Israel. You can read those in Isaiah 10 and verse 5, Lamentations 5 and verse 6, and Ezekiel 23 and verse 9. The United States and Britain in Prophecy explains how the ancient Assyrians settled in modern-day Germany. So it'll ultimately be Germany that partners with 9 other European nations to punish the United States. Every indication is that a global financial crisis is about to drop the U.S. down from its present dizzying heights, allowing Europe and its allies to usurp America's economic dominance.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You know, we've been talking about America's imminent economic collapse for quite a long time. What would you say to the individual who basically says, yeah, we've been hearing about this for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, and it's never really happened? Why is it any different today?
Right. Well, the timing of economic collapses is definitely hard to get right. There's a lot of factors that go into that. But I think everyone except the most radical leftist economist would agree that when your debt gets to be more than it's usually 100% of your gross domestic product, which America just recently passed, you are in a bad spot because of that that debt death spiral I was mentioning earlier. You get to a point where you're either spending more on interest than you're spending on defense. In this case, you're actually getting to the point where all new borrowing comes to just paying down the interest. And so once you get to that point where you're running $1 trillion deficits just to pay the interest on your debt, you are nearing national collapse. Now I can understand why people would be concerned with the timing, because I mean, I think there have been economists that were saying that we were nearing this tipping point 10 years ago. And then what happened after that is the interest rates were lowered. So lower interest rates, your interest payments get lowered, and the economy started growing faster. So even though the debt was going up, the economy is growing at roughly the same pace. And so, like I said, if the economy keeps growing at 3% a year and interest rates stay down below 2%, we can keep doing this for a while. You can keep running up these $1 trillion deficits, but you have no insurance cushion. As soon as those interest rates start going back up 3, 4, 5, 6, 7% like they were a couple decades ago, or the economy stops growing at 3% a year, you get into a recession, then it comes time to pay the piper. So like I said, it's hard to predict when those interest rates are going to go up or when the economy is going to stop growing that fast. But if either of those two things happen, when you've got as debt as high as America does, you're in a really bad spot.
You kind of answered this question indirectly in a couple of ways, but you mentioned in your report how high debt puts national security at risk. I wonder if you could just talk about some more specifics and practical ways that that ends up happening.
Right. And I think you have to break that down into two parts, because we talked about consumer debt and we talked about national debt, both which puts national security at risk when they get too high, but in different ways. The consumer debt really is more of just like a financial cushion, because recessions normally happen every decade or so. And then when they do happen, if you lose your job or your business goes bankrupt, you need a financial cushion to get yourself through those hard times. If the consumer debt's like it is now, where, like I said, 40% of Americans have no savings, and even the other 60% don't have as much as they should, many of them, you get to a point like happened in 2008 when the recession hits, people start going bankrupt, and you get a domino effect. The people go bankrupt, then the banks go bankrupt, and then eventually the whole system is going to collapse unless the government steps in and just bails a bunch of people out. And so that's a national security threat, and the fact that if people can't take care of their own financial house and you put that burden on the government, you blow up the government's debt. And then the government's debt is a national security threat for a reason I touched on before, in that financial historians like Niall Ferguson will look through history and say that normally when the interest payments on a nation's debt exceed their defense budget is when empires fall apart. Happened with like Rome, happened with the Soviet Union, where you're, especially in like Soviet Union's case, you've got secessionist movements that you can't use your military to move against, because you're broke, you're spending all your money trying to keep your economy solvent. And so America's really close to that point where even at current low interest rates, within the next 2 or 3 years, you're going to be spending $1 trillion a year just on the interest payment for your debt. And so you're like, all right, you're going to have to start cutting, either printing your way into hyperinflation or cutting programs like either unemployment or military spending, either of which you cut military spending and then you're vulnerable to foreign threats. You cut unemployment or Social Security funding and you're putting yourself at risk of domestic threats, because people have no 40% of Americans have no savings. If the government doesn't do something, then you're likely to take to the streets. So you've got a threat of urban unrest if you cut entitlement spending, and threat of foreign attack if you cut military spending.
Mm-hmm. So you are working on an article about this, and I just wonder if you might talk about what people could read if they wanted more information about this.
Yeah, actually, we have a lot of different directions we could go with things we've published over the years. We have one book written by Mr. Rob Morley entitled How to Solve Your Money Troubles, which is more directed towards the individual if you're one of those 40% of Americans who have no savings to fall back on. That book would be a good investment. It's a free book, so it's not much of an investment, but it's
no risk.
But then we also have a chapter in our He Was Right booklet going through the prophecies that Mr. Armstrong taught from the Bible, titled Our Financial 9/11 Was Prophesied. That goes into more detail about how the Bible prophecy is about a European superpower coming against the United States, and looking into how that European superpower is going to surpass the United States in terms of world power because of a global recession. At this point, like I said, America is so far ahead of Europe in like military prowess and things like that. But it's going to take a major recession to level that playing field, and have those prophecies be fulfilled. And so you've definitely got scriptural basis for a financial calamity there. And then that article also goes through that one's examining the 2008 financial crisis in particular, where they said like the world came within hours of financial collapse and was only averted because the government just started pumping huge amounts of money into the economy. Like I said, we've doubled our debt because of it. So next time we have to do that, we're going to be in a lot worse condition than the first time we had to do that because it's...
Well, that's terrific. We thank you very much for that, and we'll watch for what you have coming up on the website about this. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about America heading toward economic recession. So watch for that material on thetrumpet.com. We'll put links to those articles that he discussed in the show notes for the program today. Thanks very much, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Some of the most impressive cultural and artistic achievements in Western civilization have come from Europe. And Europeans have been celebrating this recently and are celebrating it more and more. But there is a darker side to this celebration and the culture that it points to. Trumpet writer Josue Michels has written an article titled "The Modern Revival of an Evil Culture." He's here to talk about this with us. Hello, Josue.
Hello, Mr. Hilliker.
So, they were celebrating last year the European Year of Cultural Heritage. Tell us exactly what they're celebrating and how they're doing it.
Yes, so there's many celebrations going on, organized by the European Commission and by the different nations and countries. Everyone is contributing to this, and it's basically meaning that they want to show that Europe is united through its cultural heritage. Now, when you look at Europe's history, you can see where this cultural heritage is coming from. Europe has been predominantly ruled by the Holy Roman Empire, and these emperors, along with the Roman Catholic Church, have established a culture. And this culture spread throughout Europe. It mixed certainly with paganism and with the nationalities and the different ethnic groups, but has been predominantly established by the Roman Catholic Church and by emperors who had a vision to spread that culture. So that culture mainly consists of churches, monuments, castles, music, literature, poetry, and all kinds of other things you would associate with culture, but it all has a common root, and that would be the Holy Roman Empire.
So maybe you could just talk about the scale of the celebrations that we're talking about. And I'm just curious how much, say, the emphasis on the church's role and the Holy Roman Empire's aspect of this that are playing into as they're celebrating, say, some of these more cultural and artistic achievements.
Yes, so they try to do it as much as they can because they really hope that this cultural heritage will be uniting them. And they say, if you look at the past, you can build the future, and that's the only way that Europe was united in the past. And so they say this cultural heritage is not only of the past, but it's also for the future. So in 2018, they had the European Year of Cultural Heritage, as you said, and they had over 6.2 million participants in more than 11,000 events in 37 countries. And that was just what the European Commission organized along with the countries and the different states in those countries. Of course, there are also other nations that participate with their own cultural events, and that has always been the case. But this was specifically organized to bring Europe as a whole together and to show what European unity means. And some of those events I looked a little bit more closely into, like in Germany, they had a cathedral celebration in Aachen, and that was closely linked to that European Year of Cultural Heritage. And it showcased that the European Cathedral, as they call it, which is the Aachen Cathedral, that was built originally by Charlemagne, the first so-called European Christian ruler of Europe. And he established that chapel at a time that later grew into cathedral. And he took material from all over Europe to build it. and to make it the most beautiful church in all of Europe, that all people can come together and worship there and find their way to what they call their religion, the Catholic faith. And he really believed in the Catholic Church and their doctrines, and he hoped that Europe could unite under that one religion and belief. So when they celebrated that cathedral, everyone knew why Charlemagne established that cathedral and why it's such a valuable asset for Europe, but also for the Catholic Church, as it united the empire.
So there are, I guess, a lot of people looking back at this history, a lot of people that would look at the achievements in European history and focus on, say, the greatest accomplishments of some of these rulers, and particularly in light of just the cultural invasion, if you could put it that way, that has come into Europe, that a lot of Europeans are trying to push back against that and to show this is who we are, that we can be proud of our uniquely European heritage. But they're also overlooking some of the less savory aspects of that history. It seems there would be considerable effort to airbrush some of those elements. Maybe you could just talk about how they reconcile the fact that so many of these accomplishments came because of really quite brutal leaders, that they're not paying attention to that aspect of it.
Yes, you can see that with every leader of the Holy Roman Empire you study, or every king that spread culture. It certainly is impressive to look at how Europe turned from paganism into a cultural empire that had churches, that had literacy, that had poems, that had music. That's really impressive to look at. But if you see how that culture was established, then you suddenly get a totally different view on those leaders that spread that culture. Charlemagne spent 30 years to convert the people of Saxony, a tribe in Germany at the time, to Catholicism. They just didn't want to submit to the culture, so he waded through rivers of blood, as many historians say, to convert them to turn to him, to obey him, and to accept the Catholic Church as their faith, as their belief. And it was only then that they accepted the culture and gave up their former gods, which they worshipped. And you can see that among many other leaders, they didn't accept anyone else, they didn't accept any other culture. And if someone didn't submit to that, they were brutally slaughtered, they often were tortured till they gave up their beliefs. And if they didn't give up their beliefs at all, they were brutally killed.
How do you look at this, the cultural achievements and then the history? How much do you feel, having grown up in Germany and kind of some of this is just part of the culture that you grow up with, how closely aligned are those two things? You're talking almost like it's impossible to separate the art, the literature, the music from the politics, from the military conquests. Why would you feel like those can't be separated, I guess?
Yes, just growing up in Germany, you do have cultural events quite routinely. It just increased lately. But I remember attending events that presented like little castles, and they showed what culture they had, and they showed the music they had at the time and the instruments they had at the time and the arts they had at the time. But if you think about a castle means you have, of course, people that protect the castle. You imagine it was built by many slave labor, by a king that ruled over those people, and a king that didn't really accept any other authority. And if it was a powerful king, he aligned with the Catholic Church, because that was the way to spread knowledge, that was the way to spread culture, that was the way to spread power. So if someone like that wanted to expand his empire, he also had to use more and more brutal force. And the way to connect with the people, that was just simply to establish the culture, to unite the different groups of people under one rule, under one government. It was often that this person in charge, if he was really believing that, was all the more driven to establish that culture and that rule, because that was his vision, his motivation, which made him overlook even the bloodshed that he might have caused along the way.
So you have this article, The Modern Revival of an Evil Culture, and you talk about how most historians are not really focusing on the connection between the brutality and the cultural achievements of the Holy Roman Empire. Why do you think they don't get into that?
Yes, I think that's a really, really important point to understand here, because we have historians, some look predominantly at what the Holy Roman Empire established for Western civilization. They look at the culture and they think, that's great. We would have never had such a wonderful spread of culture without the Holy Roman Empire. There are other historians that say, look at the horrible bloodshed this empire caused. Such things should never happen again. Other historians see it as terrible, terrifying, and inexplicable how leaders of the past could have ever caused so much bloodshed, so much torture, so much brutality, and have shown no love for humans, no love for other cultures or anything like that. And they say the Holy Roman Empire was the worst thing that happened in history. And there are other historians who say, as I said before, they think it's the best. But if you can reconcile that the culture of the Holy Roman Empire and its brutality go hand in hand, historians just can't understand how a cultured individual like Charlemagne or other leaders of the Holy Roman Empire who valued music, who valued arts, who valued literature, who valued architecture were so advanced in for their time and still didn't value human life at all and caused the death of thousands, tens of thousands, and over the course of centuries of millions. They cannot reconcile those two facts. But if you really look at history, if you have an honest look at it, and if you look at the culture of this empire and the bloodshed, you put them the two together, and you see why they committed all those atrocities, then you actually see that the culture of the Holy Roman Empire was one of their prime motivations to commit the bloodshed they committed. So they are not just coincidences. They actually go hand in hand. But the people don't want to look at those facts. But it's all over history, and it's proven, and it's in many statements of those leaders, many acts of those leaders prove it. But historians can't understand it because their view of culture and their view of the bloodshed is so different than of those leaders at the time.
It is paradoxical, isn't it? It seems like, you know, just the elevated state in mental achievement and capacity and intellectualism and just what it requires to make those cultural achievements just seems so much at odds with this sort of barbarism and bloodshed. And yet, looking at the history, you do just see repeated instances of those two going together. We talk a lot about the fact that this empire is going to rise one last time. That Bible prophecy discusses these repeated resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire, and the seventh and final of these resurrections is in process, taking place right now. How does the cultural revival factor into or play a role in that prophecy?
Yes, so first of all, we know that God prophesied that this empire would rise seven times. And in history, it always had this cultural aspect into it. Even some historians don't discuss it as much, but Hitler was a very cultured individual for that matter, and he valued culture a lot. So we know that every single time that this empire rose, it had that cultural aspect. But there's also specific prophecies that show that Europe today would reunite again with the Roman Catholic Church to establish once more the Holy Roman Empire. And the way they do it has always been through establishing culture, because that's the unifying clue. Religion and culture often go hand in hand. It brings the people together and it inspires them to greater unity, to fight together. So in Revelation 17 and Revelation 13, we see of that church-state union, and we see that the church, represented as a woman in Revelation 17, is actually riding this empire, or riding the beast in Revelation, which represents the empire. So this shows that this church is actually guiding this empire to do what it does. And in one aspect, that means that religion will play a greater role, that culture will play a greater role. But it is that culture that this church wants to spread throughout the world, because it wants to establish world dominion, unite the whole world under that culture. And in that, it is willing to commit again great bloodshed, because otherwise Islam would never convert to Catholicism, nor many other religions or groups of people would never submit to that culture unless they use overwhelming force to achieve their will.
Well, it's a very important subject. There are a lot of aspects to it, and you've done a good job of drawing together the history and the prophecy and what we're seeing in Europe today in this article, The Modern Revival of an Evil Culture. We appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Josue Michels about Europe increasingly celebrating the culture of the Holy Roman Empire. Check out that article, The Modern Revival of an Evil Culture, at the front page of thetrumpet.com. And thank you for sharing this with us, Josue.
Thank you. Good to be back with you.
It's time for today's last word.
I wanted to share with you an article that appeared in American Thinker on August 29th by Richard Jack Rail. The title of this article, Today's Kids Don't Know How Good They Have It. And I'm just going to read it as he wrote it, because it's very, very good. A fellow was lamenting how history just isn't seriously taught anymore in school or college. He was talking mostly about the history of the ideas that made America great. That's important, and in my JROTC classroom before my retirement, we did talk about those very things as lessons in life. In the last high school where I taught, the AP history teacher asked me to give a talk to her class on what war was like back in the days of the American Revolution. I extended it to what life in general was like in those days. I give Mrs. Brooks credit. She was as lefty as they come, but she trusted me to talk to her kids about a period in time that far back. Among other things, I spoke about the kinds of living to be made besides farming 250 years ago. Wheelwright, blacksmith, farrier. The kinds of living that didn't even exist yet. Plumber, mechanic, electrician. About how dusty and muddy the world was from lack of pavement. About how rough roads were before McAdam showed that the rocks in gravel should be less than a half inch in size. About how stinky the world was. Poor dentistry and oral hygiene. Woolen clothing washed perhaps once a month because the cotton gin hadn't been invented yet to make cotton clothing feasible and plentiful. And because people often believed baths unhealthy. About how two-thirds of all newborns died before their fifth birthdays. How death was an everyday part of life. And how crushingly hard it was just to survive, much less to flourish. Nobody of our economic class had any leisure to speak of, and nothing was easy. School, as we understand it, didn't exist. It was clear that none of these kids had ever read any real history or given thought to just how easy their own lives were and how lucky they were to be born in this era of plenty. For a month or two after such talks, kids I didn't know would come up to me in the hallway or campus and say how much they enjoyed my contribution. And that was just a single hour. By not teaching our kids about the world as it was before America, we fail them in a serious way. They have no basis of comparison, and so think life has always had cars and video games and iPhones and McDonald's. It simply doesn't occur to them that the world didn't always have Dr. Pepper or Monster or a Quick Trip on the way home. No sports arenas at all, because there wasn't the wealth, hence the leisure, to allow soccer or baseball or basketball to be invented. Pro sports, central to modern life, wouldn't exist for nigh on another century. Nor does it ever get shown to today's kids how vital America was to all the advances that gave us modern conveniences. Germany led the 19th century in science, France in literature, England in commerce, but the political system of America gave the world an economic engine that produced unexampled wealth. And wealth gave us cars and jets and transplants and telephones and lights and plumbing and air conditioning and computers. Lacking background, today's kids can't even imagine how lucky they are. It is simply beyond their imaginative capacity to feel what life has been like for most of human history. The physical discomfort, the emotional anguish, the mental strain. This being the case, small wonder they don't appreciate what they inherit. I came of age during the Nixon years. Richard Nixon once said his hope was to give America a generation of peace. That sounded good at the time, when we were mired in Vietnam. But nearly 50 years later, I think it wrong-headed. Peace amid plenty as we have today engenders laziness, lassitude, and ingratitude. The U.S. military system that sent young men all over the world exposed them to that world. It's only within my lifetime that most of the world has pulled itself out of the muck and mire. Watching that happen sobers a man. It gives perspective not otherwise attainable. Today's education system virtually ensures that no kid will be exposed to anything that will provide perspective. With greater resources than ever before, our kids have no sense of history. We have allowed the idiot left to cut them off from their own background and leave them spouting nonsense they would reject out of hand with proper grounding. We've raised them this way because we weren't aware of what was going on. But now we are aware. Time to do something about it. Even if just inviting veterans to class to talk about life during their war. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, and Josue Michels. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Isaac Bashevis Singer. When a day passes, it is no longer there. What remains of it? Nothing more than a story. If stories weren't told or books weren't written, man would live like the beasts, only for the day. The whole world, all human life, is one long story. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.